Welcome to Move Wild Podcast. I'm your host, Jake Clapson. The aim of this podcast is to explore, learn, and spread the message of rewilding and natural movement so that we as humans can live in more alignment with our nature and reclaim what it means to be fully alive. The modern world has stripped away so much that used to nourish our mind, body, and soul. This podcast will help illuminate how we can reclaim and restore our innate, wild, capable, and strong spirit. Thanks for joining me on this journey. Welcome back to another episode of Move Wild Podcast. Thank you all so much for tuning in to today's episode. So today's episode is a little bit different. My girlfriend Molly, who runs the podcast Ancestral Alignment, interviewed me for her podcast, and I thought I'd share that interview on today's episode. So that's what this episode is going to be. I hope you guys enjoy it. Let me know what you think. Let's jump right into it. You can catch me on the other side for how you can connect with me and what's going on with me, and also how you can get links to Molly's podcast, Ancestral Alignment.
Welcome onto the show, Jake. I would love you to start off firstly with telling our listeners a little bit about yourself, what you do, and where you're from.
Sure. So a bit about me, I guess. Yeah, my background, the last 6 years or so, I've been immersing myself in the world of natural movement, rewilding, nature connection, and ancestral health, namely natural movement. And coaches and mentors have been great guidance in helping me to kind of develop myself in that realm. So natural movement, for anyone listening who doesn't know exactly what that is or isn't aware of the specific system that I kind of trained under called MoveNat, it's just understanding, on a very basic level or very basic definition of that, is just understanding how we as humans are designed and have evolved to move. Just like, you know, you might discuss how we as humans are designed to eat, you know, what kind of foods that we're designed to be eating, what are the movement patterns that are universal to all human groups, and what are the capabilities and skills that are universal to all human groups, and using that to inform kind of movement and health. From that perspective, that's what natural movement is, or that's what my definition of natural movement is. So I've been practicing that for the last 6 years and exploring different and other aspects of rewilding and ancestral health, and kind of looking at human health from that evolutionary perspective and looking at human behavior from an evolutionary perspective and trying to understand that in myself, seeking out community, seeking out connection with nature, seeking out skills like hunting and fire making, and really trying to reconnect as much as I can to what it means to be human through many means. And yeah, so right now I coach natural movement. That's kind of my love and my passion, and it has been for that whole journey. And that's kind of the angle that I've taken on ancestral health, is natural movement. And that's where I'm at right now. I own and run a business called Move Wild. I have a podcast called Move Wild Podcast, and I coach natural movement and ancestral health.
Awesome. That's quite a journey and a lot of things to explore through that. How did you first find natural movement?
Yeah, so as I said, like 6 years ago was when this all started for me. So when I was 14, I'm 20 now, I was having some symptoms of what turned out to be an autoimmune condition. So I was having joint pain, stiffness. Overall, my body was in a lot of pain. I couldn't sit down for more than 5-10 minutes without having sharp shooting pain down my leg. I had to get a standing desk in school. And there were all these kind of things going on a physiological level that were telling me that something was wrong, or something that was not right, or something I was doing was not necessarily ideal. And all those kind of things, those symptoms, which also expanded into, you know, mental signs of inflammation. So autoimmune, you know, conditions are a sign that your body is inflamed on a very basic kind of level. And, you know, mentally my state was reflective of that. I was extremely depressed to the point of, you know, almost suicidal, and extremely anxious, and just very stressed mentally at 14. So I went to different doctors and specialists and tried to kind of understand how to heal myself, or at least how to manage and deal with this problem, or this set of, I guess, inputs that I was getting from the world that was telling me I was doing something wrong and I needed to change or alter the path that I was on. And their kind of messaging was take a bunch of medications and just try and deal with it as best you can. And that didn't really sit right and didn't really work for me, because even though I was taking medications, none of them seemed to really help anyway, which kind of forced me to look elsewhere for answers, which is really, you know, looking back in retrospect, is really amazing and really good on my journey. So one day I was searching online and I came across a system called MoveNat, or natural movement, and that's kind of where my journey begins from there. I saw this dude called Erwan Lacour. I found a video called The Workout the World Forgot that's still up on YouTube if anyone wants to check that out, and that was kind of really inspiring to me and made a lot of sense to me to come at exercise and fitness from an evolutionary perspective and really explore and embrace the full gamut of human capability and potential through movement. And then I just started practicing and then fell in love with it and found a coach, and I moved up to Brisbane and trained with that coach for 2.5 years, and I got to coach underneath him, and then I went on to run and start my own business and start coaching people.
Yeah, cool. What kind of was your, I guess, movement practice prior to finding natural movement, and what are the sort of flaws in that, or why wasn't that working for you?
Yeah, so I was, like, prior to that, so I'll go back a little bit further. When I was up until around the age of 11 or 12, I was kind of, like, into soccer and into, you know, I guess, more traditional sports and ways of moving and just being a kid and doing what kids do. But around, like, from probably age 9 or even just age 10 to 12, like, for a couple of years, just became extremely sedentary and became extremely kind of hooked on video games, more because that's what all my friends were doing, and just didn't really eat very well, and my lifestyle was not, it was like pretty terrible when I look back. And then around about 12, my mum started kind of researching and getting into the paleo diet, and I thought that sounded like a cool idea, so I decided to join her on that, and I cut out like wheat and dairy and thought it was a very novel kind of fun thing to do, and I felt a lot of energy, and I kind of built on the momentum of that, I guess, win for myself in changing my diet, and started embracing fitness, and became, and went from like extremely sedentary to like fanatical, to the point of like overtraining on, you know, with fitness. So I would run like 8 kilometers every day. I would cycle 16 kilometers every day without fail. I would, on top of that, do soccer training every day for a good hour or hour and a half to 2 hours. I'd do sprints. I would, you know, go on as many walks as I possibly could with my dog. I would do strength training, all this kind of stuff, like just like the opposite end of the spectrum, but overtraining massively and not really realizing, you know, the overtraining was a thing. I remember like I started getting the symptoms of my autoimmune condition around this time, and like I was having pain in my legs, and my dad said to me, maybe you're overtraining, and I didn't even know that that was a thing. I didn't know that that was a concept, and I was like, that's not possible, like, what do you mean I'm overtraining? And then, so yeah, I guess that was kind of my background pre-natural movement, was yeah, just lots of soccer, lots of like traditional fitness, and like running, lots of running. Like that seemed to be like my definition of fitness, was like, you know, how much I can run and how much I can sprint and whatever, like how fast I can go and how like how intense I can go without losing breath. That was like my broad definition, but it wasn't very well defined until I started exploring natural movement a bit more.
Yeah, interesting. I think there's definitely a big perception that is fitness, like fitness is cardio, and I guess natural movement doesn't really follow those guidelines. What do you feel like is the difference? And
yeah, well that's a really interesting point. I just spoke at the embodiment conference not long ago, talking about the definition of fitness and kind of really exploring that and understanding that a little bit better, because it's one of those things that people poorly define, and because of that poor definition, a lot of people consider themselves fit or unfit due to the fact that their definition is not, you know, for lack of a better word, it's not defined very well. So yeah, fitness, like in the broad sense, how most people look at fitness is in many ways a reductionist kind of model. Like they look at it like how far you can run, how you know, much weight you can carry or whatever. And also I noticed that fitness is very specific to the endeavors that people become obsessed with or fascinated with, rather than broad or kind of a more generalist approach, which is what I aim to do as much as I possibly can in my training and in my life. But we'll get to that in a second. But yeah, like CrossFitters, for example, define fitness based on the amount of weight that they can clean and press or clean and jerk, or, you know, how many kipping pull-ups they can do, or, you know, how far, how many calories they can burn on a rower. But a marathon runner might define fitness in, you know, how long they can run a marathon, whether they can run it in, you know, under a couple of hours or whatever it is, and so on and so forth. So it's all very specific to the person, like this, the activity. And that's what I kind of don't like, is because that leaves us very fragile, and it leaves us able to be broken. So I think, you know, the definition of being brittle is something, you know, a very strong aspect paired with something very weak. So an example of that is if my quad is extremely strong, but all the muscles and stabilizing muscles around my quad are extremely weak, that leaves me very open to injuring my knee or being weak in any range of motion where my dominant muscle is not active. And in the same sense, if all you do is run marathons, or all you do is CrossFit, or all you do is swim, or whatever your thing is, it leaves you very weak in other areas that are outside your comfort zone and outside your range of adaptability, which is, you know, one of the main things that we should be cultivating in fitness is the ability to adapt to different situations and different environments. Because when we can do that, it doesn't matter what context we're put into, whether it be a CrossFit workout, or whether it be running a marathon, or whether it be fighting, or whether it be, you know, communicating, whatever the context is, or whatever the environment is that we're put into. If we have the skill of being able to read certain stimulus or input within the environment and then navigate our way through the environment effectively, i.e. we have adaptability as a skill, then it doesn't really matter on the environment. It's more dependent on ourselves. So my definition of fitness is being adaptable. And the way that we do that is constantly change and challenge the environments that we're in, the context that we're in, so that we're never stuck too much to one spot, so that we're never like, oh, handstands are my thing, or CrossFit is my thing, I'm just going to stick to that and stay with that. Because over time, if you do that too much, then you become immovable and not adaptable. So, you know, trying to explore different things, not getting too attached to being a CrossFitter, you know, going and exploring, you know, trying to do a handstand, or trying to run a long distance, or whatever it is, and just kind of a little bit more detachment, I guess, and a little bit more adaptability and transferability of skill is what I would define as fitness, and what I would kind of encourage people to move towards a little bit more.
Okay. And so if someone was looking, like listening to this and thinking, okay, cool, like how do I actually train for this? Because being adaptable, like if I want to be adaptable to be able to fight and be able to run and do all of these things, like I'm going to have to train in order to do that, which is, I guess, a funny concept in of itself. But how would somebody train through, like what would a structure be for someone who's trying to get adaptable?
Yeah, well, find what you're averse to and go there. So if you are extremely comfortable, even like, let's say, take the context, if you're extremely comfortable in the gym, if you walk into a gym and you're like, man, I got this, like, you know, everything here is familiar, it's easy, and you walk in there with lots of confidence, maybe try training somewhere else. Like, you know, like there's people that train everywhere. Like, look at people who, you know, do parkour, for example. Generally, they want to remove themselves from a gym as much as possible, because a gym is, on in the long term, going to stagnate their growth, because the real world that they're trying to move in, or the urban environment that they're trying to move in, is the real, where the real challenge is. So like, if you're comfortable in the gym, go and explore training in just like an urban environment. See if you can, you know, move around, jump around, and move yourself around buildings, or whatever obstacles are, can be found around you, or go out and move in nature. And vice versa with that. Like, if you don't feel comfortable in a gym, like if you feel like that's an environment that you are naturally averse to, go and train in a gym and see what that's like. But yeah, I guess on a skill-based level, it comes down to understanding where you are weak and looking at that objectively, like asking the I like to ask the question, like, what if? So, you know, what, you know, this can be applied to every skill. One that I like to apply it to a lot is fighting, because that's a skill that a lot of people don't have, or don't have the will to acquire, because they want to avoid any acknowledgement that violence exists in the world. But just ask the question, you know, what if someone were to attack me violently with the aim of hurting me or killing me, or hurting or killing one of my loved ones, and I was there? Like, what if that happens? Like, am I prepared to deal with that? If the answer is no, maybe, you know, you should consider going and learning MMA, or maybe you should go and consider learning Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, not from a point standpoint solely of like, it's a fun thing to learn, which it definitely is, but from a standpoint of preparation. You know, what if someone was drowning? Can I swim and like carry back someone who's panicking in the water to shore? And not just someone who's drowning, but someone that I love. What if I'm drowning? Like, all these questions, we can go on and on and on and ask these what ifs, but that will give you a fairly clear kind of objective look at where you're weak and where you're strong. And don't be afraid to look at that. You know, a lot of people, I think, are afraid to look at, you know, a lot of people, for example, are afraid to look at violence because they don't understand it. But the more you look at the things that you're not very good at, or not very like proficient at, then the better you'll become at identifying those things and then correcting those weaknesses, in a sense.
Yeah, that's awesome. So takeaway from that would just be find what you're shit at and to just go for it and have it down with that. Yeah, cool.
And I would say, to balance that, we need comfort as an aspect of growth. So we need, I believe there's two kind of pieces to growth, and one of them is challenge. So that would be the aspect of going out, you know, if you don't know how to fight, go and join an MMA gym, or just do like a few classes there. But you also need the comfort aspect. So that doesn't have to be comfort in the sense that most people think of it, but it can be comfort in the sense that you're in an environment that you're used to. So for example, if I identify, like, I'm shit at fighting, I need to get better at fighting, you might go and take one step towards that. So that's the challenge element. You're like, okay, I'm going to do a couple of MMA classes this week. But it doesn't mean that you completely give up, you know, going to the gym if that's what you're used to. You still go to the gym. It's just that you sacrifice a little bit of that comfort of being in the gym, and you go and step out of your comfort zone and go and humble yourself, because it takes humility to say, I don't know this, I need to learn this. But it's really important to kind of step out into the world and have that attitude. And I struggle with it. Most people struggle with it because it's very kind of antithetical to the way our psychology is wired, you know, in many ways, to actually step out and go. And like, even to admit that we're not good at something, even for me, you know, to say like, oh, I'm not good at fighting, you know, my psychology is trying to work against that, and will constantly, like, even just, this is a good little mental game, like, imagine yourself in a fight. Like, think, you, when you imagine yourself in the fight, your mind is telling you that you're going to be way better than you actually would be. You know, you're thinking, man, like, if I was in a fight, I would do this, that, and the other. Like, I would own that. Like, it would be fine. Like, I'd be fine in a fight. Chances are that's probably not the case. Like, you probably freak out and panic, and it, like, unless you know how to fight, that situation's probably not going very well for you. So yeah, like, be able to say that to yourself, and be able to like objectively look at it and think, yeah, like, you know what, I am shit at fighting, because it's hard to admit that sometimes, or whatever area of our life that we're not good at.
Yeah, for sure. I've definitely struggled with that in the past. And yeah, it comes to anything, like, not just even just overall skills, but like, yeah, it comes into play with everything we do in life. Is there any certain movements, I guess, so people can kind of understand what natural movement is a little bit more? Like, we've talked a little bit about fighting and, You said a little bit about parkour, but what are the kind of movement styles and practices of natural movement?
Yeah, so I guess coming back, like, natural movement, its history comes from a guy called Georges Herbert, who kind of started something called Méthode Naturelle, and that's where MoveNat and parkour both kind of have their roots. And his whole philosophy was to be strong, to be useful, or to look at physical strength and capability as an asset to our communities, not just as a self-serving journey that we go on in order to fulfill our wants of aesthetic, you know, of looking good, or our wants of being healthier. But he saw movement and fitness as a kind of civic duty. And he observed this when he was on an island and there was a volcano and a bunch of people died on this island due to this volcano erupting. And his observation in that kind of tragedy was that most people weren't fit enough to kind of get themselves or the people that they loved out of harm's way. And that really helped him contextualize and see that, you know, fitness is not just this thing that's ethereal that we talk about, and like, you know, you need to be fit because of, you know, it's healthy, or you need to be fit because of this, or I want to be fit because I, you know, I want to have big muscles and look good, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's actually for a purpose. So I guess natural movement then, from that practical, really applicable standpoint, is like, okay, what movement or what physical skills would actually be useful in my life? Like, would it be useful for me to be able to, you know, lift and carry something, even if it's getting my groceries out of the car, or it's helping someone getting their groceries out of the car? Like, you see an old person who, like, can't bend their back to get the groceries out of the car. Do you have enough function in your body to be able to do something like that and, like, you know, carry something for more than, like, 100 meters? Are you able to, you know, carry someone if they've broken their ankle? Like, can you carry another human being? Can you get over a pretty basic or simple obstacle like a wall or a fence? Like things like that that are, like, so simple and basic, but so many people have lost the function to be able to do them because it's not required, because our world is, like, this kind of, you know, been turned into a very soft place where people don't are never asked to do anything that's very challenging. Like, all the surfaces that we walk on are flat if we want them to be. Like, I can, you know, walk from my house to my car on a flat surface with no variation in you know, context of the surface, or no variation in the environment, and that doesn't force me to, like, move mindfully. I can just switch off and be like, oh, I know the surface is going to be flat. That's, like, when has that been the case for most of human history? Like, hardly ever. Even, you know, even with the road systems being put in place in more ancient civilizations, even then, some form of spatial awareness of where you are in your physical space was required. Obviously, it's still required. You have to look out for cars and stuff, but it's being reduced more and more and more and more, is my point. But yeah, so being able to, like, do human things and do practical things that you might actually need to use, like climb over something, or, you know, get underneath something, or balance on top of something, or lift something and carry something, or fight. Like, those are, you know, those are all the kind of movements. So anything that you would need in your life, I would say, is natural movement. Like, they have categories in the MoveNat system, and they break it down into 13 different movement patterns, and I can go into that if you want. But I would say a more broad and better definition is practical movement that you would need, and adaptable movement that could be applied to any situation, whether it's an emergency or whether it's, like, walking home. Yeah,
cool. And so, other than climbing, like, over things, climbing up things, what kind of other movement patterns should people be kind of practicing, and how might they be able to practice those?
Yeah, so some very basic ones. I mean, I could talk about this for ages. There's so much to kind of unpack in human movement, and we are such complex movers. You know, stuff that we develop as babies that a lot of people have lost, but just the ability to get up and down off the ground. So, you know, the function to get up and down, the function to be able to roll and fall properly, the function to be able to support ourselves on our hands, should we need to, in like different crawling patterns, walking, running, sprinting, jumping, vaulting over things, swimming, diving, holding our breath, like balancing, climbing, as we've mentioned, lifting, carrying, throwing, catching, fighting, like all of those I would kind of be fit in there for sure. Like very basic stuff. Like it's not, you know, it's nothing amazing, but it's like all stuff that, like, if you ask the average person to vault over something or jump over something or lift something heavier than 20 kilos, like most people can't do it.
Yeah.
And like it's pretty scary to think about as well when you think about that, like the amount of physical function that people have lost.
Yeah, how would the best way for someone who's completely new to this, they may do a little bit of movement, or maybe it's just really conventional, or maybe completely sedentary, how is the best way for them to kind of approach this and learn even these simple, like, well, not simple, but like complex to us modern humans, like vaulting and climbing?
Yeah, start small. So like vaulting and climbing are definitely more complex movements. So like, can you get up and down off the ground without using your hands? And can you do that without pain? And can you do that with a fairly ready and like upright torso? And can you differentiate how your head and your eyes are moving from your body? You know, how are you organized when you're standing? Are you standing with, you know, slumped over, or are you standing upright and tall and ready? Like, it's a long process, and it's been lost over a long period of time, not only, you know, in your lifetime, but likely generationally. Like, you look back at the history of human movement, it's very similar to the history of human diet. It's almost, you know, it spans the story of agriculture, where diet has degraded, you know, slowly but surely over the last 10 to 14,000 years due to agricultural practices. The same is true of movement. Like, slowly our movement diet, or the nutrition and nourishment that we get from movement, has degraded over the last 10 to 14,000 years. So don't think it's a process that can be, you know, necessarily be restored in a day. But what I would say is, you know, set realistic and reasonable goals. Don't expect to be able to do a muscle up, for example, tomorrow, but just start small. Like, start with like, can you get up and down off the ground? Can you do that many times? Can you do that in many variations? And, you know, I offer training and resources specifically on the practices, I guess, for people to kind of follow up on. And also MoveNat offer a bunch of great resources on that for people to kind of practice and move with. But yeah, if you're going to approach that stuff, and even if you have some level of capability, like, break it down. Like, if you want to vault, like, okay, what are the steps required to be able to vault? Can I even land safely? You know, can I fall? Like, what if I fell? Can I fall safely? Okay, well, if you've got those two things in place, how do I break this down? Can I slow it down? All right, now that I've slowed it down, can I add a little bit more speed? But that's a whole system of progressions and almost too much for us to get into.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's where I would start.
Yeah, cool. And you touched on there a little bit about, like, what sort of changed in our past from being the humans that we were to the humans that we are today. And I know you do a lot of stuff with rewilding. I'd love you to firstly just tell our listeners what rewilding is.
Sure. So rewilding is based on a premise that perhaps, or the suggestion, no, it's based on the premise, I'll say, it's a stronger way of saying it, that civilization or agriculture is not a wholly beneficial system or structure for humans to live within. And rewilding is kind of, at least in my eyes, a philosophy that encourages us to look toward more natural or more ancestral ways of being in the world that honor our physiology and our biology, and were perhaps, from what we gather on an anthropological level, practiced by hunter-gatherers or pre-agricultural humans for, you know, up to 300,000 years plus, beyond, you know, like pre-Homo sapiens, but 300,000 years of Homo sapien existence. Rewilding is essentially taking that wisdom from those groups of people around the world through you know, studying them and just seeing how they live, and then applying it to our lives in order to cultivate better health. And it's, you know, it's set in the understanding that human health exists in relationship to all that is according to our nature. So, you know, human health is not a, it's not a simple thing, and it does not respond to simple solutions, or it doesn't respond, like if there's a problem with our health, for example, it does not respond to the simple solution of like, oh, just change your diet, or oh, just change your movement, or you know, or just change, you know, this and you will get better. Human health is a web of, not only human health, but human existence is a web of relationships with the world around us. And if any one part of that web is damaged or fractured or fragmented, as it is with most people in the modern world, there will be a breakdown in health, you know, which is why there's a lot of people who eat perfectly and move perfectly, but still have, you know, massive health issues, maybe not on a physical level, but on an emotional and psychological and mental level, because they don't have like the aspects necessarily of community, or they don't have the aspect, you know, other aspects in place. And it's, you know, it's so funny, like, because I've written my book How to Thrive in the Modern World, and I kind of go through the 5 chapters on like health, but you know, even that to me is like almost too much of a simplification of understanding how humans exist within the natural world, or how humans exist within this world. But anyway, like if I was to simplify the definition of rewilding, it is returning to a more wild or natural state, and it is abandoning domestication as much as possible, and seeing that we as humans, you know, through agriculture and through many factors, have in many ways become domesticated and therefore weaker and sicker.
Yeah, awesome. What were the what are some of the sort of main aspects of that web that you were talking about that sort of create our health? And
yeah, so the main aspects of the web of connections that we need in our life, one is, you know, definitely and obviously nourishment, and that doesn't necessarily have to just come from food. That can come from water and the air that we breathe, and those are two things that a lot of people, you know, don't necessarily put as much value on as, you know, as is required for those two things. But yeah, diet, so eating a biologically appropriate species specific diet, which, you know, you'll probably have more people to talk about that, and you and I are very aligned in terms of dietary principles and practices, and kind of eat an animal based diet, meaning that we get the majority of our calories and nutrients from animals as is, according to, you know, the anthropological record and what we understand of human physiology. That's what's appropriate for humans as a species. So diet's a big piece. You know, air, what kind of air are you breathing? Are you breathing in polluted, you know, toxic air with a whole bunch of, you know, fumes from off-gassing paint or, you know, cars, or, you know, whatever it is. Water, what's the quality of your water? Does it have plastics in it? Most water in the, you know, in this world is pretty tainted, and it's hard to find clean water. Like, even we order in spring water, and like even that comes in plastic bottles, and like obviously they do their best to not contaminate those things, but obviously there's going to always be some leaching of that. So you know, that's the nourishment web. Then the movement, which we've kind of already talked about, which, yeah, like, again, it's funny because, like, the way that our language system is structured, we compartmentalize a lot of things. So it's funny that I'm explaining these things as separate when they're really almost the same thing. Like, movement is separate to food, is separate to, you know, work, is separate to community. And yes, they're all webs, but, you know, natural movement on a ancestral level was not practiced. You know, people didn't, or not intentionally, I should say. People did not go out and think to themselves, I'm going to go for a walk because I need to get my movement in, or I'm gonna, you know, like, whatever it is, I'm going to go and practice this thing. They put it in the context of procuring food or building shelter or strengthening connection with community or land. Like, that was the only context that they knew natural movement in. They went running because they were hunting, or they threw something either to practice to hunt or because they were actually in the context of hunting. And then, you know, the same with, you know, the same time goes for diet, because they were hunting their food, which then sustained their ability to live and connect with other people and then share that food with other people. So why, you know, what was the reason that they were procuring that food? You could argue it was for nutrition, but you could argue it was also to strengthen communal bonds, because they were then going and sharing the food of the animal that they hunted. So it's all kind of connected. But yeah, community is a massive piece. So are you connected? Who are you connected to? And what is the depth of your connection? Those are kind of three key questions. Like, you know, in the modern world, we have a lot of shallow connections. So like, we might have, you know, thousands of followers, or, you know, heaps of friends on Facebook or whatever, but we're not very deep with any of those connections. And, you know, what that does to our psyche is it means that we don't feel very supported or very well, like, held in a community, but we also at the same time have our egos extremely fed. So it creates this weird imbalance that a lot of people have, and that, you know, in many ways that's kind of results in narcissism, or can result in narcissism, where, you know, I feel like I'm very important and popular because I have all these friends on social media, but I also have a lot of insecurity because I don't actually have a deep community to hold me. So I might experience highs and lows where, you know, I see my faults sometimes and I'm like, oh man, like, I'm really alone in this world. But then I get that dopamine hit of seeing all my friends on social media or whatever, and I feel really narcissistic and like, yes, the world's all about me. And that's like a very unbalanced way of seeing the world. But yeah, the piece on community is that we need deep connections, and you should prioritize deep connections over quantity of connections. Not to say that you don't need quantity. If you only have, you know, one deep connection or two deep connections in your life, then you need to do something about that, and you need to widen those networks of connection. But you shouldn't have, you know, like 10,000 kind of superfluous shallow connections. Like, Robin Dunbar talks about the optimal number that humans can kind of organize in their mind of relationships is maximum 150 people. And most hunter-gatherer groups existed at around 30 to 50 people in a tribe. So I think that's a good number to aim for. Like, do you have 30 to 50 deep connections in your life? Most people don't. That's something that I'm moving towards. I don't have it at the moment, but I think it's an important thing, because just like we prioritize, you know, getting enough protein and getting enough carbs and fat and whatever it is, like, in our diet, nobody's like I have 30 or 50 deep connections. And we don't know how much of a role that plays in health, because we know not many people have that. And maybe that plays like a massive role, just as much as getting adequate grams of protein in. And we just don't see the results of that because nobody has that kind of depth of connection, or very few people have that depth of connection in the world. So, you know, prioritizing community is a big piece, just as much as, you know, movement and diet. And then finally, you know, what I used to call recovery, I now understand to just simply be living in accordance with natural cycles. So it's not even a process, you know, recovery is a part of that, obviously, but, you know, understanding that the world that we live in is built on rhythm and cyclical nature. Like, whether you look at the macro, like the universe, or you look at the micro, there seems to be this recurring rhythm of night and day, you know, in the exhalation, inhalation, death and life, and just winter and summer, like all these seasons that we go through in our own lives, but also the world around us goes through. So honoring those seasons and living according to them, you know, fasting and feasting. There's all these cycles that people, like, we, like, so many, I don't know, like, the world is so funny. I feel like it's upside down in many ways, or just back to front, in the sense that, you know, in many things. But one of those things is that people want this stability of state. You know, they want to constantly feel a certain way, or think a certain way, or, you know, eat a certain amount of meals or calories per day or move a certain amount per day, and they want all this stability, but that's, you know, it's really antithetical to our nature as humans and natural cycles. Like, if I was to train the exact same amount every day for like 10 or 20 or 30 days, which is something as lauded as being this, you know, extremely healthy habit that you can, you know, kind of cultivate. If I did that for a lifetime, I don't think I'd be healthy, because there's no variability in that. And there's no, like, you know, change in that. If I did it for 30 days, sure, like, that'd be great. Like, if I was like, oh, like, I'm gonna, you know, go for a walk for an hour for 30 days, that's still within that law of cycles, because after that 30 days, I might say, oh, now I'm gonna, you know, go and do some strength and conditioning training for an hour for 30 days. Like, obviously that's a very simplified kind of way of cycling between different patterns or styles of movement, if you could call it that. But yeah, not seek to balance stability with that cyclical nature and rhythm. That's probably the last of the kind of major webs of connection and health.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'd love to touch back to community and sort of how people can create more community, because I talk to a lot of people about this, and it is hard to kind of find that tribe, like, especially being in the modern world today. Like, we have so many, like, people around us and surrounding us all the time, and we're not entirely sure who is our tribe and who's not, and just how to deepen the connections with people that you want to deepen it with.
Yeah, that's a great question, and there's so many, like, psychological and emotional traumas that come into play when trying to answer that question, due to the nature of our recent history as human beings and due to the fragmentation and fracture of most society and culture. And, you know, like, I could talk about that in depth, but more to the point, like, coming at it from a less narcissistic standpoint will be of massive help. the modern world has taught so many people that individuality and that being an individual is the greatest fucking thing that we can ever do, and it is so antithetical to community living, and it is so antithetical to ever forming a healthy, sustainable tribe or relationship. And it's funny because people ask questions like, you know, how can I create a community that's all aligned with my values? And I'm like, that is an innately narcissistic question, because what you're assuming is that there's a bunch of people out there in the world waiting for you that have the exact same values as you, waiting for you to lead them and create this community so that they can all join and like, that is, like, it's so such a funny kind of question to me, because I'm like, community is a dance, because obviously you need to have some alignment of values, but you also need to have the ability to communicate, cooperate, and live in harmony with other people. And innately, there's no other human being on this planet that has the exact same either value system or prioritization of values as you. So they might have the same, you know, values. Like, a very basic exercise you could do is, like, write out your five, you know, values in order, and then try and find someone somewhere else on the planet that has those exact same five values in the exact same order. It's going to be very difficult and hard, because I might have the exact same values as you, Molly, but you might value, you know, seeing your friends more than I value exercising, for example, as a very basic example. So there's still misalignment of values in some way, shape, or form. So it's not... the question is not like, how can I create or how can I find a community that all shares my values? The question is, how can I become a person that a community would want? That is the question that we need to be asking, because notice how innately, if my question is, how can I find a community that's just like me, or how can I create a community that's just like me? Like, you're probably not, like, that's not how the world works, more often than not. I think what we need to be asking is, how can I serve people, and how can I be someone that other people like enough so that they are willing to live in harmony with me. And obviously, I'm not talking about like pandering to everyone's needs. You obviously need to have clear definition of value in your life, but I think it is a dance and a balance between self-service and, you know, self and community service, and balancing those two things. And I think some people, most people in the modern world, and the modern world has kind of taught us this, are way too focused on self-service. What can I get out of this interaction? What can I get out of this relationship? What can I get out of this community? You know, if I create a community, I better get something out of it. And there's also some people that are too focused on community service. We need 50-50, I believe, and like anything one side over is unbalanced and unhealthy. But if we want to create a community, lead by example. So do the things that you want to attract into your life. So if you are really passionate and really value health or rewilding or, you know, whatever it is, do it. Like, just practice it on a daily basis and live it like to the best of your ability, and you will attract the people that need to be in your life according to your level of, you know, in the way that you're putting it out there, and you know, that's almost a natural process, and that will happen over time. And sometimes it takes a little bit more patience, and sometimes it takes a little more bit more time than we expect, but I've found that in my own life, and that's only growing. The things that I value, and as long as I actually do them and live them, I see people around me more and more who reflect those values. And at the same time, this community service part of that equation is that I have to be open to change, and I have to be open to be able to meet an individual who's come into my life, who I've attracted into my life, you could say, through displaying values by acting in a certain way. But I also have to be open to see their viewpoints, see how they can change me for the better, even if it's not, you know, in a way that is solely of my choosing, because identity is not a individual thing, it's a community thing. This is a good little mental exercise for people who doubt that statement, doubt the statement that identity is solely, or no, think that this, that identity is solely an individual kind of, thing, or attached only to you as an individual. Remove every other human being on this planet. Like, who are you? You know, like, you are nothing without the acknowledgement of other people. I could say that I'm a MoveNat coach, but without the acknowledgement of the MoveNat community, I'm not a MoveNat coach. I could say that I know how to do X, Y, and Z, or I could say that, you know, whatever, but without my community, I don't have an identity. So it's important to put those two things into perspective and into balance, and like, yes, you're an individual. Yes, that's great. Yes, you have unique gifts to bring to the world. But also, like, honor that you're part of a tribe, you know, or if you're not quite part of a deep tribe yet, find a way to connect with that tribe. And when you come into that tribe, balance community service and self-service, and never, you know, overstep the balance in one way or the other. One more thing I will say to that is, yeah, like, the world that we live in, you know, in order for people to feel psychologically and emotionally stable, a lot of people are in, you know, quote-unquote tribes or communities, but they're very shallow, and they're very, you know, they're focused around, for example, some people, like, subconsciously, if you don't think this, just think of, you know, look around you, and you will find this to be true in your life. A lot of people identify themselves with brands, for example. So I know this is true, or been true in my life, where I've identified myself with the brand of Natural Movement, for example. And that's my, you know, quote unquote community. But like, I interact with those people on social media, but that's about it. That's the length to my connection with those people. And then I might have, you know, I might identify, because I eat an animal-based diet, I might identify with, you know, carnivores. But what's the extent that I interact with, like, those people? It's on social media too. So, like, it's kind of, funny how the modern world is set up in a way where we feel like we're a part of a bunch of all these tribes and communities that are delocalized and kind of digitalized. But that's all, you know, those connections are very shallow, and like a good way to test whether, you know, you are in a community or whether you even have just a strong relationship with someone is just ask the question, have you been through something hard with that person? Or have you been through some, you know, thing of adversity with that person? Even if it's just like fucking like going on a hard hike or something, like, you know, or like going fishing or, you know, going on a trip and getting lost. Like, it can be something as simple as that, but have you gone through some form of adversity with that person? Chances are that's, you know, a real relationship. And then if you haven't, we'll try and find a way to do that, or maybe, you know, that's a, you know, that's not a relationship that you're deep enough with yet.
Yeah, that's awesome. Was there anything else that you wanted to touch on in regards to, you know, natural movement, rewilding, nature connection, anything like that? I know you speak a little bit about nature connection, and I'd love to kind of go and talk a little bit about that actually, and just what is it, and just kind of tell people a little bit about that.
Totally. Well, nature connection is like, again, it's such a funny word because it's like, it assumes the position that, which is true, that we are like disconnected from nature and we need to, you know, like just like natural movement, you know, I'm just, it's like, it's so funny that that's a word. It's like, you know, if like, I always imagine like if there's some aliens watching us from outer space and they would like just be making fun of us. Like we, like these guys need to like teach themselves how to move in the world and like, or how to eat, or how, you know, like how to connect with nature, which is where they come from. It's just such a funny concept. But yeah, nature connection, you know, is very similar to rewilding, or, you know, can be interchanged, I guess, similar things, I guess, two different cultures and worlds in some regards. In my eyes, nature connection is, again, just a tool for us to use in order to live a more ancestral life way. So being connected to natural rhythms, cycles, and the natural world will be beneficial to not only our health, but also our ability to kind of move through that world and better understand ourselves as humans. The very basic overview of nature connection. One thing, if it's all right, I will touch on before we wrap up as well, is, like, what do we do with all this kind of information and how do we move forward? Because I'm really a big fan of, you know, like attaching philosophy, which, you know, which has been the majority of what we've been talking about today, you know, these big kind of discussions around what it means to be human and like how we move through this world, attaching that to an actual application or an actual kind of way to move forward. And one thing that I will say, like, what do we do with all, you know, this understanding of how, or even just applying some of the stuff that we talked about today, like, we have been, you know, maybe it's a strong word to say, like, damaged, or like, we are in the position that we are in, I should say, as humans, due to a generational process. This is not, like, I was not born into this world after, like, you know, my parents were not hunter-gatherers. This has been, like, a slow degradation of human existence over time to the point where we're more and more sick. You know, people might be familiar with Pottinger's cats, which is a study done on cats where they, you know, they took two groups of cats and they fed one of them cooked meat, which is not their biologically appropriate diet, and they fed the other one raw meat, and they found that within 8 generations or 7 generations, the cats that had been fed cooked meat were infertile. And I think that that's happening to the human species on like a global level. Like, the more we move away from acting and living according to our nature, the sicker and the more depressed and the more problems that we're having essentially as a species, and that's becoming more and more prevalent, and like just at a rate that is becoming like kind of like you have to numb yourself to it almost in this day and age. Like, people in their 20s or teens or kids who are like suffering with health problems that are, that, you know, no person, no matter what age, should have, regard, you know, like, let alone kids or let alone, you know, teenagers or whatever. So yeah, just understanding is that it's been a generational process and it's been a generational degradation of health, and not only health but connection. Like, it's been a generational degradation of social structure and healthy community and healthy communal ties. I've spent some time up in Arnhem Land, and you can very clearly see, you know, amongst all the trauma, and due to the fact that the trauma has been very recent in that culture's history or that those people's history, you can see a deep connection to their roots, and you don't see that, you know, much with people like you and me, other than the fact that we're trying to go back and explore this stuff just from a, you know, purely our standpoint of where we are and how we understand health. But we don't really have like strong lineages to hunter-gatherer society. I was never taught how to hunt. I was never taught, you know, where my land is and the stories of my land and who came before me and the generations and ancestry and all these stories and things that taught me how to be in the world. And, you know, I didn't have any of that, and I'm just trying to figure it all out on my own, like figure out the human story and where I come from as a person, you know, from an ancestral perspective. Yeah, so I guess when we look at it and understand that it is a generational thing, it will help us to understand that rewilding, and if people don't like to call it that, maybe let's just call it reclaiming full health and vitality. That will be a generational process, because we can't expect that something that has taken 10 to 14,000 years will, you know, just reverse in like 30 years or whatever.
Or 30 days.
Yeah, exactly. Or whatever, yeah. Like most people are expecting. And even like, you know, facial structure and bone density and brain size have been decreasing since the agricultural, you know, quote unquote revolution or age. And that kind of stuff, it will improve if you eat an ancestrally aligned diet and move, you know, in a way that's ancestrally aligned. But it's not going to improve, like, even within your lifetime. Maybe your bone density won't be as optimal as your kid's bone density, and maybe their bone density won't be as optimal as their kid's bone density if they keep doing the right things. So, yeah, like, play the long game. Like, play the game of, like, this is a generational process. I'm going to do the best I can for my kids, but my kids are going to be so much healthier than I am and have so much less trauma and have so much more connection. And their kids, hopefully, are going to have so much, you know, they're going to be so much healthier than I am, and so on and so forth. And the more that we can focus on that, I believe, rather than focusing on just constantly being in this mode of, like, trying to get results, you know, as soon as possible, or like expect that things will come in like 30 days or you know, whatever, 30 years even, like, don't even expect it in your lifetime. Just plant the seed and the tree will grow, but it might not be here for you for its fruits to bear. You might not be able to eat them, but maybe your children and your grandchildren will be able to eat them, and you can lay rest assured and happy in that knowledge that you have set yourself up and the world up for a brighter future.
That's a really beautiful way to look at things, and yeah, I really like that, and looking at it from a larger point of view and seeing that, you know, things can be reversed, and that in the long run, like, things will only get better if we put in the right efforts. And I think it's a very, very interesting thing to say what's right or wrong, and I think that, yeah, looking back into the past of when we were healthy and vital and had energy and we had connection and there was, you know, more, yeah, just more general health, that maybe that is key, and that, you know, coming back to some of that is going to create a lot more health for us.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And that's a really important point, which is that a lot of people have good intentions in this world. Most people that you'll meet have good intentions in this world. More often than not, the case is that either their philosophy of how to go about securing those good intentions, or their methodology of how to meet their needs or meet their aims, is off or not in accordance with nature or some, you know, law of the world or some law of the universe, and that's where often we don't get the results that we want, is because we might have the greatest intentions in the world to do the greatest good, but if we, you know, if our philosophy is off, then it doesn't matter how good our intentions are. And just this, in the same way, if our methodology is off, like in the same, like if we have these good intentions but we're going about it the wrong way, like to not to pick on any particular group or offend anyone, but veganism is a great example of that. Like most vegans, or all vegans, I could probably confidently say, have the intention to be healthy and vital and vibrant. I would argue strongly that the methodology that they use to obtain that goal is antithetical to human nature. That's, I guess, a good point to end on.
Yeah, and I guess just touching on that, that's a bit of a big discussion in and of itself, but that, yeah, I guess how the methods that we choose to follow through with and we believe is going to create health for us are generally not something that we came up with, and that these ideas have been presented to us and we believe that, you know, that all the research and all the people that are telling us, like, this is it, like, you know, this is the way to eat or move or live or this or that or whatever, just really backs that up, and that we go with that and we're not so willing to change that. Like, I really resonate with that. I was vegan for 2 years and I genuinely believed that was the way of life, and that was, you know, the way to, like, that was the healing of, like, myself and the world. And, like, looking back, I'm very, like, coming back to that, looking at things with an open mind and being like, that was my values and beliefs back then, but I realized that actually wasn't working for me as best as I could. Like, I felt all right, but, like, moving and changing that allowed me to create even more abundant, vital health and a lot more energy in my life. And yeah, I think that's just something, a good little note to put in there, that not necessarily it's our fault of our state of health or, like,
yeah,
our decision. It's what we're presented with and what we've led to be, like, what we've been led to believe.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think the way to combat being fed or presented a methodology that doesn't serve us is to develop a great ability to, you know, what is commonly known as critically think, or the ability, you know, to have critical thinking. I just finished reading a great book called Sand Talk, and the whole book is kind of, from my understanding anyway, based around indigenous thought patterns and the knowledge and the wisdom that can be gained from indigenous ways of thinking. And those systems of thinking are very much, yeah, I highly recommend people check out the book. Like, it's just one of the most amazing books I've ever read. But, you know, those kind of systems of thinking, I think, can really help us view the world in a more balanced way, and really help us to understand, you know, perhaps what methodologies will serve us, and see the interconnectedness of all things in the world, and see, you know, that the answer is not always obvious, but if we understand the interconnectedness of, like, of life and how we as humans play a role within the ecosystem rather than try and dominate the ecosystem, like what the human animal, you know, how we as the human animal kind of fit into the natural world, when we understand that a little bit better, I think that it becomes a lot easier to understand, like, what methodology works and is according to nature, and what methodology or system or, you know, process or whatever you want to call it is antithetical to nature.
Yeah, I think that's a really great way about going about it. And I guess once you kind of begin to learn that overall broad perspective of looking at things, it becomes a lot easier in individual situations to be able to choose how to respond to them in the most, like, health supporting ways.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, and each situation is different. Like, one thing that he talks about in that book is that one thing that I kind of glean from it is that all all knowledge is contextual. And that's one thing that, like, I don't know, from my experience anyway, the modern education system kind of doesn't get across to most people. You know, the modern education system, or our way of educating or teaching, is very much a, this is what works, go and do it, without any, like, this is how this concept may apply to different scenarios, go and figure out how to apply it to your specific context. Like, that is the way of thinking that, you know, perhaps can be applied to your specific context, and perhaps works a little bit better, because all wisdom or all knowledge is contextual. You know, someone might, you know, someone from far north Queensland might tell me, oh, you should never go in the water. And I might take that as gospel and then apply that to all different contexts and be like, oh, I should never go in the water, without realizing the reason that he says you should never go in the water is because that's a rule only for his context where there's crocodiles.
Yeah.
You know, like, totally. Whereas, like, here, yeah, it doesn't matter because there's no crocodiles where I live. So, you know, that's a very basic understanding, but the same could be said of all knowledge that you ever receive. Like, even what we're transmitting through this podcast, you know, like, it's all contextual. It's all, you know, apply the knowledge to your context, don't take it as just a blanket statement. Don't take it as, like, you know, a great one is like, get out in the sun more. Well, if you are, like, burnt and have been, like, out in the sun in the desert for, like, 3 days, you should probably avoid the sun at all costs.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's,
yeah,
we,
for sure.
We say these blanket things that we think just apply to everyone everywhere, and we forget that all, you know, all knowledge or all advice, is something to be applied contextually.
Yeah. Awesome. That's a really nice note to end on, a little good reminder for people. I'd love to just get some details of you and how people can connect with you.
Sure. So people can connect with me. I have a website. I'm sure you put that in the show notes. Instagram @move_wild. I'm pretty active there. Also, I have a podcast, Move Wild Podcast. And if people want to get a free copy of my book, they can go to ancestralhealthcoaching.com/book and you can download a free copy of my book there. Otherwise feel free to reach out on Instagram or via my website. I'd love to connect with different people and see what they thought of the episode, and yeah, we'd love to have some good conversations around this and continue the discussion.
Awesome. Thanks so much for coming on this one, Jake.
My pleasure. Thank you. It was an honor to be on. Thank you all so much for tuning in to today's episode. So if you liked today's show, got value out of it, then please take a screenshot of this episode and share it on Instagram stories and tag me @move_wild and Molly @MollySternhell. You can find her Instagram account down in the show notes too. We'd really love to know what you thought of today's episode. Also, if you haven't already, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review on iTunes. That goes a long way, or whatever podcast platform you listen in on, I should say. That goes a long way towards getting this show and this message out to more people, helping to spread the good message of rewilding, natural movement, ancestral lifestyle, to help us reclaim health and vitality as a species. So again, thank you all for tuning in. I'll catch you on the next episode of Move Wild Podcast, coming out this Friday.